Before we start today's podcast, if you're planning on doing any shopping at Amazon.com, please go to our website, MysteriousTopics.com, first and click on our Amazon link. In doing so, you will be supporting this podcast with any purchases you make. We will be getting a small percentage of that, and it will keep this podcast going into the future. We appreciate everyone doing that to this point. Everyone, welcome to Mysterious Topics Podcast. This is John, and today I'm talking about Vermont spooky places with Nancy Kozoil of Vermont. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, John.
Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think this will be a lot of fun. Now, first, how did you become interested in these types of topics, spooky, haunted things?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I grew up in the 80s, and I'm kind of convinced it's amazing any child survived the 80s. They were like the wild, wild west. I feel like, you know, I was never supervised really, and my friends and I kind of ran wild. I feel like kids were abducted like three times a day. It's amazing that anyone lived through the 80s. But it was also a time when books and television kind of celebrated and explored dark stuff, even for little kids. And I was kind of a weird kid. I didn't have a ton of friends, and I spent a lot of my time reading. And I was always really fascinated by ghost stories and spooky tales and kind of like speculative stuff. Like as a child, I loved The Twilight Zone. I really think my parents should have been paying closer attention, but
yeah.
And there was some stuff on Nickelodeon, like The Haunting of Cassie Palmer and Children of the Stones, Into the Labyrinth. Just weird shows that were really, they were geared for children, but they were really kind of creepy. And then you add to that things like Poltergeist, and it's like you had no choice but to just kind of love, you know, all of this kind of unknown, spooky, speculative type stuff.
Yeah. You know, I think just the opposite. I think parents should be happy when kids are watching things like The Twilight Zone, because it's, first of all, it's usually very good writing, and it just gives a different perspective on things. It really makes you open your mind more, I think, anyway.
Yeah, I guess the problem is I was kind of a scaredy cat. So, you know, it would get to be bedtime and I'd be freaking out about whatever I had seen and not wanting to go to sleep.
Yeah, I suppose at a certain age, it's a little young. I remember watching The Twilight Zone and Outer Limits when I was young, very young. And then, like you said, going to bed and leaving the light on. So
Yes.
So you're a freelance writer. What do you write about? What's your area?
Officially, my specialty is wine. I'm not a somm, so I actually focus more on like wine culture and the politics of wine. If I could get a grant or do research for someone, I'd really be interested in studying more of climate change, which is something I believe in, and how it's not only changed how we're producing grapes and the flavor, but also how consumers' preferences have been changing over the decades, especially with a more kind of rapid rise in the temperature. So when I'm not freelancing, I create content for a little digital marketing company whose job it is to help small businesses and websites get found on Google. So I write about everything. I write about real estate, windshield wipers. I do some writing for NYU. And so that's what I do to pay the bills. And then I usually, when I'm not doing that, I try to focus on, I write fiction. So that's kind of my passion. Yeah.
Have you finished any yet, or everything kind of in the working stages?
I have two novels in draft form, one of which I hope to query in 2017. And then right now I have a couple of short fiction pieces submitted here actually on Monday, if one of them has been accepted. So fingers crossed.
Oh, great. Yeah, that's great. I've kind of dabbled in that when I was younger. And as you are probably well aware, it's one of those things that it's really hard to do on the side. You really have to commit to it.
You do.
Yes. Okay. Well, as far as the spooky Vermont Chuck and I did a podcast that you suggested a while back on the Bennington Triangle. And I was just wondering, have you been there and have you had any experiences?
Yeah, I loved when you guys did that. I really appreciated it. It was so much fun because we actually live pretty much in the Triangle.
Oh.
Yeah. So my husband and I live right in Bennington, Vermont. At the time you did that podcast, we were living at our old place, which bordered the woods. We actually moved. We bought a loft downtown. So we're not quite in the Triangle anymore. So I'm an avid geocacher and a hiker. And so I was always checking out trails when I came to Bennington originally. Bennington is part of the Appalachian Trail. The part that's here in the state is called the Long Trail. And that's where the Bennington Triangle really sees most of its activity. It stretches from the Mass border, which is maybe 7 or 8 miles south of us, up to Glastonbury, which is a town in Vermont that technically no longer exists, but there's still a sign for it. And it does still appear on maps. So before I knew about the Triangle, a girlfriend and I decided we were going to go do some hiking up there with my dog, who was just a puppy at the time. And there are some switchbacks going from Harmon Hill to the Goddard Shelter, which is a pretty popular part of the Long Trail. So we were going up there and my dog just, she really freaked out. She had her hackles up and she was really agitated, which, you know, especially for a puppy, was really unusual. And, you know, this is a dog I've had her since she was 6 weeks old. She's going to be 15 in a couple of weeks, which is insane to think about. And, you know, she's never done that since. And we hike with her, you know, at least once a week. So she, you know, she used to kind of run ahead and check things out and then come back. But this day up in the Triangle, she like would not leave. And eventually she didn't want my friend and I to go any farther. She kind of kept growling at us. And, the thing that was really weird at the time, like that just terrified me at the time, although in retrospect, I think I have it figured out, is oftentimes if the trails are overgrown or like depending on the time of year, if there's leaves or snow, hikers will build cairns, little piles of rocks.
Yes.
And they'll indicate there's a turn here or, you know, yes, you stay straight here. And there were a lot more cairns than usual. And it was, you know, it was probably September or October. It wasn't a time when the trails, you know, when you couldn't see them. And we thought that was weird. But they all had this stuff coming out of them, these like long black hairs, and it looked like human hair. And I was just like, okay, nope, we're going. And, you know, looking back, Bennington is kind of it's a college town. We have three colleges local to us, and Bennington College has a film program. So I think about it now and I'm like, okay, I probably didn't need to scare myself silly. It was probably kids, you know, either a prank or running a, you know, trying to set up a short film or something, but just at the time it was really scary. And it still doesn't explain why my dog was just like, nope, I do not want to be here. I don't want you to be here. We need to go home.
Okay. Well, a couple of questions. First of all, what kind of dog is it?
Oh, so she's a rescue. She's a mutt. She's got some beagle, lab, chihuahua, and dachshund.
Oh, okay. She does have the entire
yeah, she's got the spectrum.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was just wondering because depending on the breed, it could tell us a little bit about that. Some dogs are really easygoing and others are more energetic and tense in that. So,
yeah.
But that doesn't help there. And as far as this human hair-like substance, was there a lot of it?
So it was like as if someone took, you know, just kind of picked up, like if you had, you know, long enough hair to do, if you just kind of picked up and pinched in your fingers, like maybe a quarter of an inch lock, basically, but it was very long.
And there was just like one piece of it, or was there it in more than one cairn?
Oh, no, it was in more than one cairn.
It was.
There were a group of them that had it.
So it wasn't like someone on a spur of the moment, if they just decided to start cutting their hair and putting it in there, they'd basically be bald by the time they got out of there.
Well, maybe not bald, but yeah, they'd be missing quite a bit. Yeah. It was really bizarre.
Yeah, that is bizarre. You didn't by any chance take a piece along to have it maybe examined or something?
No.
Yeah. Well, I would just like to know if it's, you know, that would be really interesting to know what it was exactly.
And, you know, it was one of those things in the moment of just, you know, it was just like terror. I mean, I was much younger then and it was a little bit dark out, and, you know, we were always telling spooky stories. This was this is one of my girlfriends that, you know, we're always kind of sending each other links of, you know, creepy mysteries to check out. And yeah, it was just a perfect storm of, ooh, we got to go.
So you knew about the Bennington area?
We didn't know about the Triangle. We knew about some of the other kind of creepy places
okay.
in town.
Okay, so you had that idea that there might be something weird happening in that area.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So you're kind of in that mindset. Okay. Now, in that podcast that Chuck and I did, we did talk about the Bennington Monster. Do you have any other information about that that we didn't cover?
No, that one, that's actually kind of died down back in like 2003 or four or five. There was a resurgence of sightings. And so it was in the news quite a bit. And that was the first time we'd heard about it in a while. Someone actually went up on Route 7 and put up a sign that said Bennington Monster Crossing, and they did footprints across the road.
Yeah.
But we haven't heard anything since then. It's been, that one is kind of dying down, I think. They kind of come and go in cycles.
Okay, well, for anyone that doesn't know about that, we did cover it on our Bennington Triangle podcast. You can go back and listen to that, but just quickly, it was a long time ago, what was it, the 1800s sometime possibly, where they were taking a carriage late at night and it started raining, and all of a sudden this big hairy human looking creature came out, and I think it maybe even hit the side of the carriage or something. I can't remember the story exactly, but then it disappeared back into the woods, and that was the main sighting, I think.
Yeah, and every once in a while, especially during hunting season, like in the 80s and 90s, you would hear stories of, you know, somebody spotted the Bennington Monster, and it's like, okay.
Yeah. So. And now, Glastonbury, is that in the Triangle, or is that near the Triangle?
It's near the top of the Triangle, and I need to learn more about it, but I've been kind of, there's going to be a guided hike this spring where they take people up, and it was a town, just, you know, a settlement in early Vermont. And then at some point, I think in the early 1900s, they had a resort up there, and they had a little trolley that ran to the resort. And after a while, it just kind of, the resort went out of business and people just started moving away. And so it's just kind of this abandoned little town up in the woods. And a lot of times when people talk about the Triangle, some of the disappearances, I believe, happened. It's more toward like Somerset, whereas that's the only place where they found someone who went missing from the Triangle. They found a body. And I forget who that was. But yeah, so it's like the northern part of the Triangle.
And this is a town where it, I guess there's a little bit of mystery, but it just basically doesn't exist anymore. They kind of intimate that it just vanished, but people just started moving away, I suppose, because the only industry in the area, I think, was logging and making charcoal and that. And there are one of the links I have on it has some images of old kilns that they made to make the charcoal with, and that it's kind of interesting. They did have, as you said, it was a resort. They have pictures of a casino, and you can see the little trolley car going up to the casino. Kind of interesting. They had a casino even back then.
I know. Yeah, it's kind of strange to think of.
Yeah. So as far as the mystery of Glastonbury, is there any more of a mystery? Because it seems to me like it, like any other area where industry dries up, people naturally just start moving away. And I know there's not much left, they say, but that just happens with time, I suppose.
Yeah, I think the mystery is more, it's very kind of a beloved local lore. People like to make it something mysterious when it could just be people moved into town because that's where the manufacturing was and that's where, you know, you could get all of your resources. But it is a huge spot for UFO sightings. That's if you hear hikers come back and say that they saw something, it's usually around Glastonbury, and that kind of keeps it alive. I'm not so much into the UFO and cryptic side or cryptid of the mysterious topic spectrum, so I don't know as much about it, but I know that that's kind of a hotbed, the Glastonbury area, for people seeing things.
Oh, okay. And this area is also very, very hilly, right?
Yes.
So if you go hiking in this area, it's not like you're just easy stroll. You're going up and down hills and small mountains and that sort of thing, and it's a real beautiful looking area.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. We're very lucky to live here.
Now, as far as the next area, the Brattleboro Retreat, can you tell us about that? It used to be an insane asylum?
Yeah, it used to be called, I believe, the Vermont Asylum for the, I'm not sure if it was the insane or the criminally insane. And it's, you know, it's an older facility. It's brick. It's got the iron gates. It's very ominous looking. You know, it's not the type of place you would want to go ask for help on a dark and stormy night if you got a flat tire. And that has been there forever. But way back when I think, you know, mental illness maybe wasn't looked at as closely as it is now, and when people just kind of locked everyone away, the doctors up there came up with the idea that to keep the patients healthier, they needed to do manual labor. And so Brattleboro is on the Vermont side of the Connecticut River. So there's mountains on the Brattleboro side and there's mountains on the New Hampshire side. And then in between them, you know, there's the cliffs and then there's the Connecticut River. And so up near the cliffs on the Brattleboro side, they had patients build a tower. And it's just a round Rapunzel looking tower that it's all made out of brick and stone. It's got a staircase up to the top. It's got some really remarkable views from what I've seen online. The lore is that patients weren't just building the tower. They would go up there and throw themselves from it. And there's supposedly a specter that you can see in the evenings who throws themselves from the top and then disappears before they hit the ground. And that's new to me. I had never really heard of, I'd heard of the retreat, and I've been, you know, I've driven past there countless times, but I had never known about the tower or about this specter. And there's quite a bit about that online. So of course, Chris and I now, my husband, Chris, we're very eager to get up there and check it out.
It's abandoned now, or is there something else?
No, the retreat is now, it's called the Brattleboro Retreat. And it, they specialize in helping adolescents who have mental illness. So, oftentimes, kids who are in crisis with their mental illness. So not, it's not an outpatient facility. It's more for if someone has some sort of crisis, they're harming themselves, or they're at risk of harming themselves or others, or they're in a breakdown. It's a residential facility where kids can go there and get the kind of 24/7 help that they need before they go back to wherever they live and they get regular outpatient treatment.
Oh, okay. And the tower, do they still use the tower, or is it just kind of an observation deck now?
It's so now it is out. There are a bunch of trails in the woods. The retreat has a lot of property that was always, you know, kind of maintained to keep people away. And now they've turned it into hiking trails. And there's a trail called the Tower Trail that goes up there. There are rumors that there are tours, but that's actually not true. But a couple of times a year, I think it's twice a year, they open it and you can go up and look. And the rest of the time, they keep it locked.
Yeah, I can imagine if people were throwing themselves off, if they probably want to keep that closed.
Yeah.
Even now, yeah, with people. But I'm looking at an image from there now, and you're right. It's an exceptional view.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful 360 view. You get woods on one side, and then you get the river and Mount Wantaquasset, I think is how you say it, over in New Hampshire.
Oh, okay. And you said, so people can still drive up there and just look at the observation tower from a distance, you say, and then you might see this image?
Yeah, you can actually hike right up to it and be outside of it. And from there, any place where you can see the tower from, people have said they see this figure. It's like a shadow that jumps.
The people running the retreat now don't mind if people hike to it?
No, the trails are completely open for the public, and the retreat actually helps maintain the trails.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know that.
I think a lot of it is they're trying to get rid of the stigma that the retreat is a bad place or that people there are bad. So they're very active in the community, and they help maintain the trails, and they do the signage and the maps. And so anyone can go up, and there's tons of trails. There's all different kinds. And that's a very popular one.
Yeah, that sounds like a great trip for the day and get some hiking in and possibly see an apparition.
It may be.
Okay, now the next one that you mentioned was Emily's Bridge. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So that's up in Stowe, Vermont, which is up north. It's a pretty famous area. It's where everybody goes skiing from out of state. kind of a really big resort town. And it's also where the Von Trapps settled after they fled Austria and came to America. So the Von Trapp family lodge is up there.
Oh.
And I believe some of the surviving Von Trapps still live in the area. And so it's a very big tourist spot for people who come visit Vermont. And one of everybody's favorite spots to visit is Emily's Bridge. And there are two different versions of the story that I know. And they both kind of follow the same idea, which is, I think, standard in haunting stories. You have a young woman and her lover who wanted to get married. Her family disapproved of him. And so one night they arrange to meet and she goes to the bridge and her family does something to make it that he can't be there. I don't know, they run him out of town somehow. And so she thinks that he's forsaken her. And some versions are that she threw herself from the bridge. Some are that she hanged herself. And then the other one is he stood her up at the altar. And so she got in her carriage with her horses and that she was driving recklessly and fell off of the bridge. And so she's, the belief is that she's still there. Vermont is pretty well known for its covered bridges. It's kind of a staple of what you think of when you think of Vermont, and they are everywhere. But I think Emily's is the one with kind of the most attraction for having a ghost. They all kind of have their own spooky stories, but that's our most famous. And the belief is that if you drive through it between midnight and 1 o'clock, you may see her or your car may have scratches on it. There's some, I sent you a video. There's some photographs with people always see orbs.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think some of the other pictures were photoshopped. They were a little much. But the other belief that's kind of interesting is that Emily ignores women, but it's men that her spirit will go after on the bridge. So if you go up there, with a group of guys, you're more likely to kind of experience her wrath than if you have women in your group.
Yeah, I can imagine. And just knowing that going there, you'd be, as you showed the video that you sent me showed how they were, they're in that mindset. So any little thing that happens, they're going to be kind of jumpy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But nevertheless, now that group that was on the video didn't see anything while they were there, but they saw these orbs and another sort of image on their film when they got home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the image is, to me, it's almost, you should have left it at the orbs. It would have been more believable, but it's still interesting to see. And it's also really interesting just how many people still kind of embrace that, ooh, this place is haunted. Let's go. Let's go do this. There's something kind of nice about the fact that, people still want to believe. They want to go. They want to see it for themselves and experience it.
Yeah. And I'll have a link to this website is called emilysbridge.com, but they are mentioning here that some people using Ouija boards reported that Emily said that she was killed on the bridge by her fiance's mother. So there's another little twist.
Oh, I'll have to look that one up. I like collecting those kinds of stories and comparing and contrasting, what makes them up. So I hadn't heard that one.
And it also says that if you happen to go there, as you said, between, they're saying 12 a.m. and 3:30 a.m. Strange noises are heard on the bridge, such as footsteps, ropes tightening, a girl screaming. Many have reported seeing a white apparition, as we said. And so they hear banging noises from Emily hitting the vehicle on the outside, or a dragging sound across tops of their cars.
Oh, that's terrifying. I have this picture in my head now of her hanging there.
Yeah.
And their car is, hitting the apparition as they're driving. That's terrifying.
Yes, I know. That would be, that would make it even more tense if that were happening. So just another thing for people to check out if they're in the area, if they want to do that.
Yeah, and it's a cool town. It's a great little tourist town in Vermont. So definitely kind of a fun place to go and have a drink to calm your nerves after you go up there and run into Emily.
Yeah, and there's a lot of really good skiing there. I know my wife is from the East Coast, and they used to go there when she was a kid quite often to go skiing.
Oh, cool.
Okay, so now we'll head back closer to your area and Bennington College. and there's a mansion there that apparently has some interesting things going on.
Yeah, and so I've always been, I wouldn't say a skeptic, but I often believe that when I get freaked out, it's more kind of my love of all things scary. But that's the one place where I feel like if I've ever been in tuned with another dimension or another side, it's there. So the college is built on an old estate, and the Jennings family lived in the mansion, which is on kind of the top of campus. And it's a beautiful old mansion. It's huge. And it is now the music building. So Mrs. Jennings, who was the last surviving member of the family, she lived there and said, when I die and it becomes property of the college, I want it to be the music hall. And so the house, when you go up there, the rooms still look, for the most part, like the parlor. There's a large sitting room. Those still look like sitting rooms. It's a big place for faculty parties, and they do the pre-graduation cocktail party there. And then a lot of the smaller rooms have been turned into practice rooms for the students. So there's a lot of, you know, pianos and other instruments. But the house itself is a place where anyone who's been up to the college will tell you that they have experienced something. Mrs. Jennings passed when her wheelchair fell off the balcony from one of the upstairs rooms. And, you know, there's, of course, was she pushed? Did she jump? Or was it just an accident? But people say that, you know, she's never left. Her presence is, you know, she makes it known. And one of the places where she's felt most prominently is the basement of the house. It is very spooky down there. It's, you know, typical Vermont, you know, old house, unfinished dirt basement. And it's just very kind of left the way it was. There's just weird old stuff that never got moved. You know, you'll see like a piece of landscaping equipment or a stack of books. And it's just, it's something you would see in a horror movie. Just very creepy. It's never been cleaned out. And so when I was in college, I used to work up there in the summers for a camp where high school students could take two college classes in the summer. And one of our jobs as residence advisors was two of us every night had to patrol the campus and hang up these papers called the dailies. And so it was just a sheet that was printed at night that showed the activities for the next day. If there was a performance or if there was going to be a local trip, if the bus was going someplace into town. And of course, when you did this, you were also checking to make sure that none of the kids had snuck out and, you know, none of the townies were on campus hanging out. And so the last stop of the night was always that you had to walk up to Jennings, and you can only get there through the woods. There's not an open way to get there. So you would have to walk through the woods up to the mansion, and then you were supposed to hang the dailies on all of the bulletin boards inside. But we usually just put a stack kind of in the door and then ran away and said, nope, no, whoever comes up in the morning, feel free to hang them up. And, you know, like I said, it's one of those places I was fascinated with this kind of stuff. And I was friendly with one of the security guards. We would go up there, get our mag lights and our walkie talkies. And, you know, I would ask him all the time, have you ever seen anything? Have you ever heard anything? Have you ever felt anything? And he's like, I'll take you up one night. Like, if you really want to go there at night, we can walk the building. I was like, well, I don't even do it when I'm supposed to do it. I don't want to do it on my own. But a friend of mine that I worked with, she's like, you got to do it. She's like, I'll go with you and we'll do it. So the three of us went up there one night, and I felt dread. There's no other descriptor. There's a hallway on the top floor of the house that has glass, like skylights almost. And I remember walking through there and just feeling absolute dread. And for no reason, you know, we were talking about just inconsequential stuff, kind of chit-chatting. And he's like, oh, there's a room over here where supposedly if you practice there at night, she'll slam the door if you make a mistake. You know, it's one of the lores of Mrs. Jennings's. I gave the building for music, and if you make a mistake, I'm going to let you know that I hear it. And he's like, you know, we should go in there and, you know, you can see it. And supposedly the door will slam if you make her unhappy. And, you know, so we're just chit-chatting. It wasn't one of those, you know, quiet moments. And just all of a sudden just kind of stepped into this one area, and just, it was like feeling panic, but there was no reason for it. You know, I hadn't heard anything. I hadn't seen anything. I just was kind of gripped with this feeling of absolute terror. And then there are also in the house, there are hot spots and cold spots that people report where, you know, the temperature will be, you know, it'll be a spring day, but then you'll hit a certain point in the house and it's very, very cold.
So when you were walking through this house at night, did you have electricity? Were you turning the lights on as you went, or did you have flashlights or what?
We had flashlights. I think we were going for the ultimate scare factor. So we used our flashlights.
Okay.
Rather than having the lights on, except in the basement. In the basement, there was no way I was going down there with lights on. Yeah. So we did lights on down there.
And the room that you said you felt the most dread in, I just wondering if that may have been the bedroom where she may have fallen off from you, or do you know that or not?
No, so it was actually in the hallway. Oh, okay. There's like a long hallway, and it wasn't outside of that room. It was down the end of the hall from that room. But there was just this kind of one spot that was like this little bubble of bad feelings.
Yeah, that's interesting. We were just watching American Horror Story, the latest season, and this sort of reminds me of that. That's about a haunted house, actually in North Carolina. And just watching that now, I would probably have a hard time going in a house like this at night.
Yeah, we watched the first, you're braver than we are. We watched the first episode of this season of American Horror Story, and I said, nope, it's too scary for me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we got through the whole thing, and it gets pretty crazy. But but after watching that, would you definitely think twice about actually doing something like this yourself?
Yeah, and and the house actually is somewhat famous for people who are horror fans. The horror author Shirley Jackson wrote the book The Haunting of Hill House, and it's based on. Well, she was inspired by Jennings Mansion. She lived in North Bennington. Which is a tiny little, all of our towns are tiny, but it's even smaller than Bennington. It's only a couple of blocks big, and that's where the college is. So Shirley Jackson, the author, she lived up there, and Hill House, which was also made into a film, I think in the late 60s, is based on Jennings. And she's also known, if people don't know, The Haunting of Hill House, the short story that we, most of us had to read in high school, The Lottery. Which is a really terrifying piece of fiction. She wrote that. And when she was living in North Bennington, she wrote that.
Oh, well, that's neat.
Yeah. We do a reading of it every year locally. They do a reading of it, I think on her birthday, maybe. And people come out from town and they stand in the square and listen to everyone talking about it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, what do you know about the cemetery at the college? Apparently that's been a hot spot for activity also?
Yeah, so on the other side of campus, away from Jennings, so basically if you were to look at the campus as kind of a portrait-sized piece of paper, you would have Jennings at the top and what's called the end of the world on the bottom. And that's just the name for where the campus kind of goes into being just wild fields and then goes into somebody's farm. And down on that end, if you walk past some of the houses. They don't have traditional dorms at Bennington. They have these clapboard houses. So they're like little bedrooms and shared bathrooms. They look very, you know, they look old. They are very old. So if you walk kind of beyond them, there's a little trail through the woods that goes to a cemetery. And that's another place where people have had all kinds of sightings, UFO, you know, strange lights, unexplained lights and sounds, but also there are a couple of figures who are known to hang around. There's a tree that is kind of the center of everybody's tales that they see people, shadowy figures, apparitions hanging out at this tree. And when I was there in the 90s working, there was a gravestone that supposedly would go missing. And so people would go at night to see if it was there and kind of freak themselves out with that. I don't know if there was, you know, I don't think there was a standard. It's this stone. It was just kind of, again, that lore of something weird is going on here. But the kids keep a Tumblr up at the college where they share, you know, their experiences up there. And it definitely is a little weird. You're on a college campus. There's housing not too far. You cut through, you know, you can't even really call it woods. It's a few stands of trees, really. And then you're in a cemetery, and like most of the cemeteries around here is very old. You know, this is not a cemetery that's being used now. It's very, very old stones.
Yeah, well, I could definitely see kids going to college there and heading out on an evening to see what they could see.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of neat.
Yeah, it's definitely a good place. Bennington College is very creative. It's not a traditional college or university. You don't have a major. You kind of design it yourself. And they focus a lot on the arts. So there's a lot of really, you know, creative students. And it's definitely a good place for that. There's a lot of things to kind of tickle your brain with. One of the women who went missing in the Bennington Triangle was actually a Bennington College student. And so that's, you know, they kind of own that. And that's a big thing for them up there, too.
Was this the area where she was wearing a red jacket and somebody else, or was that some other place?
She's the one that she told her friends she was going to go up for a hike, and she passed a couple. She might have been wearing a red jacket. She passed a couple and turned a corner, and then when they turned the corner, she was gone, and she's never been seen again. Well, she was one of the last ones to go missing. I think I'm going to see if I can find her name here quickly.
Yeah, I remember looking at that somewhere. Now I can't find it myself, but they were basically saying that people are now at least superstitious about wearing red and walking in that area.
Kind of like
a bad luck charm or something.
Weldon. Her last name was Weldon. She was a sophomore.
Okay.
Paula Weldon. She went missing in 1946.
Yeah, and they never found anything, any trace of her.
Yeah, they never found any. The only one that they found a trace of was Frida Langer, and she was found up at the Somerset Reservoir. So the question also becomes, was she a victim of the triangle, or was it something else? Because most people believe that there is a stone on the path in the triangle that if you step on it, you just get swallowed into another dimension.
Oh, and okay. That's, yeah. Isn't there a story like that around Glastonbury, possibly, too?
Yeah. Well, and it's the same. The trail goes up to Glastonbury.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's the belief, is that there's this one stone. And I wish there was kind of someone to be like, it's that stone there. You know, I'm always curious, like, is it big? Is it small? Would you know?
Yeah, I wouldn't be stepping on any stones at all.
I just try to avoid it.
Probably be very difficult in that area to avoid all rocks.
It would. Yeah. It really would. But yeah, so that's always kind of been the belief, is that it's a dimensional issue, because there's also my favorite person who went missing there, I guess is a weird way to say it, but my favorite piece of lore is the man on the bus, James Tedford. He is, so Southern Vermont is very, very rural. And so from where I live in Bennington, which is the extreme southwest corner that borders New York and Massachusetts, it's 37 miles across the bottom of the state to Brattleboro. And there's one town in the middle called Wilmington, which is kind of a touristy town. It's right below all of the big ski resorts like Bromley and all those. And so the bus used to run from Brattleboro to Bennington with a stop in Wilmington. And so this man, Tedford, got on the bus. And after the Wilmington stop, he just disappeared. And so, it's said that somebody saw him before they hit where you cross the Long Trail. And after that, he was gone. All of his belongings were there. I think his glasses, his bus timetable, and his luggage were still there. But he was gone.
And nobody saw him jumping off the bus or anything.
Yeah. Nope. He was just gone. And, you know, and that's one of the really interesting things, too, is this kind of idea that I guess you don't even have to step on a rock. If it wants you, it's taking you. You know, we drive past there, you know, a couple times a week. And it's kind of a strange thing to think that, you know, in this kind of small amount of time, these five people just up and vanished.
Yeah. Or to us, the up and vanished, who knows? It could be some sort of alternate universe or dimension, as you were saying. And he all of a sudden, he'd never noticed anything. He's still on a bus somewhere else, and maybe things are slightly different.
And he's somewhere in the multiverse.
Yeah, he's in another Yeah, he's in another reality that might be much better or much worse for him, but he wouldn't even know. And the same with the student walking up and stepped on a stone, and she just goes back, and maybe things are different. But
yeah, it's really fascinating. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, there's so many possibilities. You know, there's the multiverse or some other sort of dimensional, but it's. And it hasn't been active in a long time, but I will tell you that every year there is a night where we hear it locally that search and rescue is up there. Because when people go missing on the trail, they are very quick to get up there and look for them. And my husband and I talk about it a lot. And you know, we say, no, the town can't shake what happened, even though, you know, I guess other people might say, well, it was only 5 people and it was only over a span of 5 years. And it's like, yeah, but when you live in an isolated community and people just vanish and, you know, no clues, no sightings, just gone, the town is not going to forget that immediately. And so it's, I know, when we were living up at our other house in Bennington before we bought this place, there was a night, a girlfriend of mine texted me and she's like, there's hikers missing on the long trail. I was like, yeah, I thought I saw search and rescue out. And I'd say like every 18 months or so, probably, you know, on average, like 18 months, every 2 years or so, somebody goes missing up there and it's like everybody comes out to help look.
Yeah. And I think you also mentioned in an email to me about how the people of Vermont hold these stories close and they take them seriously and that they don't like people that are just kind of making fun of them.
Yeah. You know, and I'm not a Vermonter. By birth. I'm a Vermonter by choice, but I've kind of learned that it is part of our culture that even if we don't believe completely, you know, things like Emily's Bridge or, I mean, it's hard not to believe the Triangle because we know people have gone missing in that area. But even if people don't attribute some sort of supernatural reason to it, we all do kind of take it seriously because it is really a part of our identity. That, you know, we do have these kinds of places that, you know, they have a lot of history and they hold a lot of energy and something, there's definitely something going on here. Who knows if we'll ever figure out what it is.
Yeah. And as far as that's concerned, I'd like to know your opinion on what you think is going on with apparitions. You seem to be drawn towards that area.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, something like Emily's Bridge, I think a lot of times that's kind of like an urban, typical urban legend. You know, something happened, someone had an experience, and then the story kind of, the narrative builds, and people really start to kind of fill in the gaps and create a story. And for me, I do believe that there's some sort of energy that events leave behind, and that it's more pronounced when there's some sort of tragedy. So, in a case like Emily's Bridge, who knows? It could be that something terrible happened there and that it kind of remains, that energy is felt, maybe as a reminder, maybe because that person is stuck, because they haven't figured it out and found healing for themselves. And the same thing with the tower, you know, is it that we convince ourselves that there's an apparition because we have been told that there's one and we've been told people threw themselves from here and it was very tragic? Or is there really some sort of almost like a geographic memory where it's imprinted on that place? You know, that some physicists think that all time is happening now. The past is still happening and the future is happening. And, you know, maybe some things just get ingrained a little bit more and stick around for a while. Because I definitely think that there's energy.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there could be two separate things going on with apparitions, as you suggested, with almost like a geographical recording where the area could actually record a traumatic event such as Gettysburg, which I've been to, and people do see things there, but it is almost like as you said, a recording. Maybe it's not, and a lot of ghost sightings are like this, where you see something, where they report they see something that's just happening, but they're not, they don't appear to be sentient. They don't say anything to them necessarily.
Right.
And then there are the other ones where the ghost or the apparition appears to be sentient and can communicate a little bit with people. And that, so that would be a different thing. But I think they're both they could both be, you know, happening. They're just kind of a different situation.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good distinction that you make, this kind of idea of like the event repeating itself versus, you know, the person who is, you know, aware, the spirit or apparition who is, you know, aware that they are there.
And as you said, maybe stuck and trying to figure out how to, or they don't even realize maybe that they can move on or that they're dead, right, and that sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting to think about. So, yeah. So I think we've come to the end of most of the areas. Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you'd like to talk about?
I think that's all. Those are the big ones. Those are the ones that I'm most familiar with that I've been to. I haven't been to the tower yet, but we're going to get up there. I've been to the Emily's Bridge and to the college. But yeah, for anyone who's interested in spooky stuff, Vermont has a wealth of spooky stories, and definitely Shirley Jackson kind of gives any of her stories, give a really good, she had a really great way of kind of capturing the mood of Southern Vermont and the types of stories that we tell each other here. So like The Lottery is a great piece of short fiction that people should read if they kind of want to see typical Vermont folklore.
Right. Anyone interested in these sorts of things, it would be a beautiful place to visit just for the scenery and that as well. So I would definitely recommend that. Not necessarily hiking all the way through the Bennington Triangle, but maybe standing on the outskirts looking in.
Yes. Yeah. You can stand in the parking lot and get some really beautiful views.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably what I would do. Especially with those sightings of the gigantic snakes. I wouldn't want to run into those.
I haven't heard about gigantic snakes.
Yes. Or that is is it the Bennington Triangle or is it the one in Massachusetts?
Oh, I hope that's the other one because I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, one of them. We covered the other triangle. Now I can't remember the name of that one.
Bridgeport, maybe? Bridgewater?
Yes. Bridgewater Triangle. Maybe that's the one with the giant snakes. Hopefully that is.
It is. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with me today, Nancy. I really enjoyed it. And as I said, it sounds like a great area of the country.
It is. Thank you. And thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Okay. And for more on this topic and many others, you can go to our website, mysterioustopics.com. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.